So let me just give you a brief sort of background. I started on this work actually in 1999, and I started this work with Doug Laufenberger at MIT. And at the time that I started this work with him, I think the goal was to come up with as you put it, a mechanistic model of how phospholipid dynamics take place in a cell. And as I sort of heard the people today, it was a humbling experience. I came sort of to the realization that, you know, models are probably not at the point where they can shed too much light on
mechanism. Ready for social security. So, there won't be any social security.
Yeah, yeah. So, I think at the end of the day, if models can shed some light on, or at least see some basic agreement between the general dynamics that we see, or if we can even come to some sort of a consensus on the class of models, I think we would have made some progress. Anyway, so let me begin by actually, the first part of my talk is essentially going to confine itself to really stating exactly what it is that I want to model and what I don't. The first slide is a very general slide, and I'm just going to move through it really quickly. So when we got started on the problem, it's clear that since the chemoattractant gradients that you apply are relatively mild, but the actin polymer profiles that you see inside the cell are relatively localized at the front of the cell, it's clear that there must be some mechanism for amplifying the external signal. The second property that you would like to capture in any model you construct is that the amplification, it turns out, must occur, if the cell is to be sensible, only for sufficiently large gradients. And, you know, various numbers have been thrown, 1%, 2% over the length of the cell. But the bottom line is it can't be zero. It must be some positive number. So there must be some sort of a threshold beyond which the amplification kicks in.
So if I mean, these profiles do two things. One is that they create this localization, and the other thing is they make that thing move.
Yes.
And you're focusing on the first.
Yes. So if I might add, I mean, the general belief is, and that's where I guess I see Lewis Wolpert come in and ask the question every time somebody mentions the word actin polymerization. I mean, he's not here. Thank God for that, yeah. Is the fact that very soon, oh, he's coming, okay. Soon after you apply this gradient, you see these phospholipids that live in the membrane more or less get polarized at the front end. And the belief is that these phospholipids that collect at the front end are somehow responsible for triggering the process of actin polymerization that then drives the membrane forward. And where I think Lewis has reservations about it is whether actin polymerization has a role to play in pushing the membrane forward. Okay, but I'm just telling you what the consensus is. I'm neither a biologist nor a physicist. I'm an engineer, so I'm just telling you what is there in the literature. Okay, so let me now actually, since I'm going to talk about a model later on, let me sort of clearly state just what it is that I want to model. So this is, and so a lot of it is going to be a repetition of some of the data that has been shown, but I'm just going to show it again to basically narrow down what it is that I want to show. So it turns out that if you really watch the cells move, you know, so if you have a micropipette and you're watching the cells move and you watch the manner in which they polarize, the polarization actually waxes and wanes. You know, it goes up and it comes down, it goes up and it comes down. So the picture kind of looks something like, it's a very brief video, but you can see that it goes up and it comes down, okay? So there is some mechanism for taking it up, and then there is some subsequent mechanism for taking it down, and this is consistent with the fact that, you know, the motion of the cell is inherently cyclic. You know, it puts out a pseudopod, and then that process of putting out a pseudopod and making the movement is sort of cyclic. It is repeated over and over again. So in what I'm going to present, I'm only going to be concerned with the first part of it, which is the accumulation of the stuff that allows you to develop a localization in the first place. And quantitatively, it has been found in Henry Bourne's group, this picture is taken from there, that the amplification that takes place is, you know, they've quantitated it, it's roughly 6 times the chemoattractant gradient in neutrophils. So if you apply, so this outside white line is, you know, what the chemoattractant profile looks like, and the line inside represents what happens to the PI, the phospholipid marker that is inside the cell. So this is part of what I would like to capture in the model. The second thing that I'd like to capture in the model is what was also presented by, I think, several people, but also I think there was a bit of discussion about it when Henry presented his stuff, and that is what happens when you subject a cell to what is presumably a uniform chemoattractant stimulus. In other words, you basically surround the cell with what is macroscopically a uniform concentration. And I'm just going to repeat the picture, although you have just seen it a little while ago, because I want you to notice the fact that what really happens is that soon after you subject the cells, what does it matter? Is that right? What happened?
It's a
looping
world.
Yeah, it's
this. My movie is better than your movie.
Yeah. Actually, let's see. Okay, let me see if I can. Okay. All right, so what happens is that initially the stuff collects, if you can notice, all over the cell, but ultimately it finally does polarize at one specific location. All right? So even though you started off with a macroscopically uniform concentration around the cell, ultimately it did decide to go in one specific direction, and the direction appears to be must be completely random simply because there was no preferred direction to begin with. Okay, so this is one issue that I will address as I go along. The third thing I want to point out here is that, and this was I think brought up yesterday and I think today as well, that it turns out that the situation is slightly different in dictyostelium, so I'm told, and so I thought I'd put it up here. It turns out that in dictyostelium, and correct me if I'm wrong, what happens is that if you do the same experiment, which is to surround the cell with a uniform concentration of the chemoattractant, you find that initially the stuff, the marker for PIP3 and PIP3 goes up dramatically, that is on a time scale of about 5 to 10 seconds, and then there is a slow return over a time scale of about 200 seconds, so the entire stuff comes back to the cytosol, and then after that process has taken place, the cell eventually extends the pseudopod. So there is this intermediate stage during which the stuff comes back before the polarization takes place, and I'm given to understand that this intermediate return is due to a process called adaptation, which has to do with the cells zeroing out the nature of the environment, and this is a part that I will not be dealing with. Actually, to be more precise, we had this in the model earlier on, and I'll show you where we had it, but in what I'm presenting to you today, I will not be dealing with it simply because the specific mechanism that we appealed to in the model was later found to be not consistent with the experiments. Okay? All right, so the third thing I want to show is also something that has been the subject of considerable discussion today, and that has to do with how a cell behaves when you take a cell that has already developed a pre-existing polarity. So you have already exposed the cell to a gradient, and having exposed the cell to a gradient, it has already acquired a polarity, and it has this pre-existing polarity. And now you want to find out how will the cell react if I change the direction of the chemoattractant gradient. And what you find is, and this stuff that I'm showing to you is partly shown through data, but I have talked at length with Orion Weiner from Henry's group, so I'm saying this on the basis of personal communication with him, but I'll show you the videos as I go along. So the picture here is the following. You applied some sort of a gradient and you got the cell to polarize at this end. Okay. Now what you do is, having obtained this polarized cell, you, let's say, reverse the gradient, and what you find is that if the gradient that you apply over here is a shallow, and by shallow, I mean a gradient whose influence is felt all the way to the pre-existing edge. Okay? So in other words, you reverse the gradient over here, but you reversed it in such a way that even at the end, all the way over here as well, the influence of the gradient is felt. If you do that, what you find is that the polarity actually moves from the pre-existing end to the new end almost like a wave. It just travels along and moves to the other end. Okay? And let me show you the video to show you what it looks like, and I hope I do a better job with the video this time. So here is the video it's not exactly clear from the video, but you can see that the polarity is kind of moving along the body of the cell. Okay? So, as I note over here again, in this particular case where the gradient is shallow, the new pseudopod or the ARP3 localization, because this was the marker that was used to track the polarity, does not form at the new location. Instead, the existing polarity swivels around, as Orion put it to me, it just swivels around and moves to the new location. Okay? If you were to do the same experiment, but you were to apply a very steep gradient, in other words, you were to apply a gradient so steep that it drops almost back to the basal level before it reaches the end of the cell by putting the pipette really close by or something like that, then in that case the behavior is somewhat different. In this case, what you find is that the pre-existing polarity simply drops, dissolves into the cell, and a new polarity develops at the point where you expose the cell to a new gradient. Okay, so let me show that to you in the video so that is also clear. So if this is the video, so here you see wherever you apply the pipette, you immediately see a new light come about there, and the pre-existing light seems to get dimmed and washed away. Okay, so the general picture here is that in this particular case, what you see is that the existing PI localization retracts and a new one develops precisely at the point where you have applied the new gradient. Okay, so these are the sets of data that I want to capture, and as I pointed out, so I'm going to get to the model now, but to orient the physicists who are here. Yes? Sure. Okay, let me see. Okay, so watch. The moment you apply it, you see this light, you move it, again the light moves to wherever it is. So in other words, as soon as you move, I know it's a little fast, I don't know how to slow it down, but basically it just tracks the movement of the pipette. Wherever you apply the pipette is where the light comes up, and wherever the light was previously, it simply retracts. Okay? Boy, these are actually, no, I don't actually. These were taken from, I wish Rick Fertel was here. These pictures are taken from Rick Fertel's lab. Yeah. Yeah, I'm yeah, no, whoever I look for runs away, yeah. Come on. Oh, is that right? Yeah, so what is the time scale between the...
Each, you can see, actually, in this particular case, you can see each of the frames, each frame is 6 seconds.
6 seconds, okay. Yeah, there was a question here. This is Dictyostelium, was neutrophils, but as I pointed out, I talked to Orion personally. I met him actually in January. And discussed, and he told me that this is observed in neutrophils as well.
But it's harder to make happen in neutrophils. That is, if you took a neutrophil and did it with a pipette just like this,
yeah,
it wouldn't respond most of those places, most of the time.
Okay. Yeah.
But what you have to do there is you have to put it up right smack next to it, and then you can sometimes get a response there and sometimes not. And I think the difference is just when you've got a highly polarized cell, like
yeah,
neutrophil, it's more resistant at the back,
okay,
than this cell is. This one is resistant at the back, but not as much.
Okay.
So it's easier to, but it's a matter of degree.
Okay.
Henry,
I'm saying this.
I think it's more experimental skill.
Okay. So, before I go on to the model, I mean, to orient the physicists here, I want to point out that the model is essentially a Gearhart-Meinhardt type of model. And what I want to show you is that most of these dynamics that you're observing are really consistent with the Gearhart-Meinhardt class of models. Okay? So, so having said that, I think at least for the physicists, it's pretty clear that we're looking at coming up with some sort of an activator that is synthesized autocatalytically but diffuses slowly, and with an inhibitor that inhibits the activator and diffuses rapidly. Okay? And the experimental phenomena that we wish to capture, or the dynamics that we wish to capture, are A, the localization of the phosphoinositides in response to both the non-uniform perturbation and the uniform chemoattractant gradient, where, as I pointed out earlier on, you develop a polarization, but in a sort of random location. Okay, yes?
As was mentioned yesterday, I guess, by slowly and rapidly, You actually mean in space, not in time.
Right? Yes, and so one is going to have a much higher, in my case, one is going to have a much higher diffusion coefficient than the other one.
Well,
it will. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
But in fact, I think it's diffusion length, neither.
This is dispersion.
It's diffusion length.
It is diffusion length, yes.
Right, so this makes it sound like as if it were some kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And diffusion coefficient is also, it's actually diffusion length.
Yeah. State. So it's a spatial length. Yeah. I agree with you. So it's the spatial range of the diffusion. One diffuses much more. Maybe I should change it to further lengths, and the other one diffuses to smaller lengths. Yeah, okay. Okay.
There's one thing here that it makes it different from the Geller-Leinhardt. The activator is not promoting the inhibitor.
It does, yeah.
You haven't got it on this.
Right. Yeah, okay. It will as I go along. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, just to repeat once again, so what I'd like to explain are two experimental observations. One is the localization of the phosphonostigen response to the two gradients, and the second thing is the movement of the pre-existing localizations in response to changes in the direction of the gradient. And by this I mean, if you recall, whether you apply a shallow or a steep gradient, the manner in which it moves from one location to the other is a little different. Okay? So, with that, let me come back to the model. And I know that the model that we, you know, when we put this model together back in 99, Doug Laufenberger told me it's got to be mechanistic. And so I have mechanisms in there, and I know there are plenty of you here because there's PLC, so I can already see a lot of heads will be shaking saying, why the hell there's PLC? But I will show you later on what data led me to consider this particular mechanism for developing the polarity. Okay, so bear with me as far as the mechanism goes. So the what I'm going to give in the next four transparencies is an intuitive explanation, and then later on I'll give you the mathematical model for it. So the intuitive explanation is essentially that when you activate the receptors, the assumption is that you activate PI3 kinase, and the activation of PI3 kinase leads to the production of, let's say, a small amount of PIP3. And if you produce a small amount of PIP3, which, as was pointed out, it is speculated, is capable of recruiting GTPases, possibly RAC, possibly CDC42, then that can activate PI5 kinase. Okay, and I'm appealing here to work that was done in John Hartwig's group, done with platelets. So I'm talking about, at that time I thought platelets is equal to Dictyo, but now I know that nothing is equal to nothing. So but let me just go on and, you know.
And vice versa.
Beg your pardon?
And vice versa,
yeah.
So,
I mean, you know.
It's very hard to change slides.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's a slow-moving slide.
Yeah. So you activate the PI5 kinase, and once you activate the PI5 kinase, it's a well-known fact that phosphatidic acid is a strong activator of PI5 kinase. So you can see there's the potential for a couple of positive feedback loops here, which can lead to the accumulation of a large amount of, starting from this point here all the way to phosphatidic acid, you could in principle build up a lot of substances. Now the other point to note here is that most of these things live in the membrane, and so their ability to diffuse is somewhat restricted. They can't diffuse very far. Okay, so one of the reactions that is also taking place here is this reaction, as I want to point out, from PIP2 to diacyl glycerol, which was also mentioned by Dan in the morning today. And this reaction is mediated by PLC. And there are several isoforms that I think were spoken of today, PLC beta, PLC gamma. In any case, the point is that this releases IP3 into the cytosol. And the reason why, and I'll get to it in a minute, I looked at this model and thought of these as being possible inhibitors, I will bring to your attention in a minute. So what happens is that this stuff is released into the cytosol. Now, I'll show you in a minute with a very intuitive slide that the net effect of this particular autocatalytic activation that I just showed to you is that essentially, you have, So essentially you have rapid buildup of phosphoinositides in the membrane. And so maybe I missed out one point here. So the total pool of phosphoinositides that you have in the membrane is relatively small, okay? And so from the evidence that I gathered, it would take about 2 to 5 seconds for the pool to be completely drained, unless and until you had some way of replenishing the reserves from the endoplasmic reticulum. So anyway, so what I want to point out here is that essentially the net effect of this rapid feedback is that you build up a lot of stuff in this area at the expense of stuff in this area, and also that the whole cycle starts to turn a little faster. And I'll show that to you by a very sort of intuitive slide. So what I'm showing you here is this. I've lumped all the stuff that was living in the membrane into a single pool, which I call P. All the stuff that lives in the endoplasmic reticulum as a single pool, which I call P sub S. And essentially what you have is P sub S moving to P, and then P is moving back to P sub S, and there's autocatalytic feedback from P back onto itself. And I'm assuming here that synthesis of P is autocatalytic and cooperative at small p, and by that I mean it is an increasing function of P at small p, and cooperative I mean that it's sigmoidal, so it goes up cooperatively. And I assume that it is self-limiting at large p, which means at large p it starts to drop once again, and that is because if you make too much P, then the stored phosphoinositides become too small, and so you can't support the thing the other way. In other words, P plus P sub S is equal to a constant. Too much of it on one side will
I'm having trouble with which P is which.
This is the membrane. This is the membrane phosphoinositides.
You've got lowercase P also. Here you see.
Lowercase P
down
is
down here.
Here, yeah, that is. So I, in the notation, I use P to denote the entity and small p to denote the concentrations. That's sort of, yeah, that's the way we. So when I say capital P, I mean the entity, small p, to denote the concentration of that entity. Yeah. I'm not a physicist. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, the bottom line is then that you have this sort of a profile, and it is coming about from an expression like this. And I have a small constant term here to denote the basal level at which the cycle turns, regardless of whether or not it is being activated by the receptor. So there's a basal level at which it turns, and then this K plus is a rate constant that would go up or come down depending on receptor activation. So basically, the intuitive picture here is that if you activate the receptors and increase this constant K plus, then this curve gets kind of lifted. Okay? So initially, you have a situation where this is the rate, this is the kinetics at which you're forming P, and this straight line here is the rate at which P is being driven back to P sub S. Okay? And you are sitting at this steady state over here. Now imagine that you activate the thing by receptors, increase K plus a little bit, this hump-shaped curve shifts up a little bit, and if you shift up the curve sufficiently, you can see that your steady state will jump from this point to this point. In other words, if you have an autocatalytic process, you can have fairly dramatic changes in the steady state. So picture this as something that's happening point-wise at each point of the membrane. Okay, this is just an intuitive explanation. So anyway, the picture basically shows that at the new steady state, which the leading edge would acquire, you would have not only a high level of the phosphoinositides at the front end, but you would also have a much more rapid turnover rate. Okay, so the reaction is also taking place faster. Okay, so having given some idea of why you would develop a high turnover rate and a high concentration at the front end, the next question is, what keeps it there? Why doesn't it simply diffuse out and spread all over the place? Because if you accumulate high concentrations at any point, it should have a natural tendency to diffuse outward. And so that is where the concept of an inhibitor comes in. And I'm going to appeal to this as the inhibitor, and I'm fully aware of its deficiencies at the moment, but I'll tell you where I'm coming from in the transparency after this. So the picture that I had at the moment is that as this stuff develops and builds up into higher and higher levels at the front end of the at the leading edge, it is simultaneously releasing IP3, which is breaking down to inositol. Okay? This inositol is being released into the cytosol. And because the cytosol is aqueous, stuff can diffuse much faster in the cytosol than it can in the membrane. Okay, so you have a fast diffusing component right here. This inositol is known to sort of be involved in the process that is regenerating the phosphoinositide. So it is involved in this reaction over here. So the general picture here is, so imagine this as the leading edge. Here you're producing a lot of PIP2 and PIP3, these phosphoinositides. As these things are produced, they release this IP3 into the cytosol, which zips across the cytosol, spreads all over this place, and so you have a much higher concentration of this inositol in this region. And to the extent that my assumption that inositol drives the reverse process is true, you would have the situation where stuff would be driven from the membrane to the endoplasmic reticulum, and so you would deplete the membrane of these constituents that I just pointed out to you. So you would end up in this picture with a situation where you would have a high amount of this stuff at the front end and a low amount in the endoplasmic reticulum, but away from the leading edge, the picture is just the opposite. Okay? So, let me show that picture to you now also intuitively. So intuitively, what's happening at the trailing edge is that once again you have these kinetics for the rate of formation. Okay, because the inhibitor is just coupled to the formation of the activator. Same kinetics of formation. But the kinetics of removal are like this. And if you notice, the kinetics of removal have not only P, but they also have an inhibitor. They're also dependent upon the availability of the inhibitor. Okay, so when I increases at the back end, what you basically have is that the slope of this line shifts a little bit higher. And so the net effect is that away from the front end, you have a situation where the concentration of the phosphoinositides drops and the turnover rate also begins.
You were saying kinetics, that implies time to me. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Or is this in relationship to distance?
By kinetics I mean, so I'm doing a really intuitive picture here. Actually, in reality, I'll show you an equation. So what I'm imagining here is that I go to a particular point in the membrane. So what I showed you earlier on was supposing I look at a point.
So that's a distance.
No. I focus. Yeah, so because actually I have spatial variations in this problem, you see, to really do a rigorous analysis of the problem, I must consider diffusion and all those effects. But for a moment, I'll put that aside. I will focus my attention and I will look at point-wise behavior. So I'll go to a point, and at that point, I'll ask myself, what is the rate of formation and what is the rate of removal? The balance of the two will give me the steady state at that point. Then I will go to the back of the cell. And again, I will do the same analysis. I will look at the rate of formation and the rate of removal and get a feeling for the steady state. Does that answer
the question? In time. The steady state in time. So he does that.
Okay, so now to the question of PLC. You know, the issue has been raised frequently that, you know, PLC is not important. These were the two papers that led me to believe that PLC has a role to play. The first one is a paper by Alan Wells in fibroblasts, okay? And what they found basically is that if you block PLC, there is no motility, okay? The second paper is actually a paper by Maxfield's group at Columbia, a series of five or six papers, and I don't know, nobody's here seems to talk about them, so I don't know why. These are actually in response to work that was done by Sally Zygmunt in 1978. In 1978, she did an experiment in which she claimed that if she abolished the calcium transients in the cell, it had no impact on the movement of the cell. Okay? Then in a series of four or five publications in the 80s, Maxfield's group showed that if you abolished calcium transients, yes, it was true that under certain circumstances, there was no impact on the movement, but these were not physiological situations. Only if you observe the movement of the cells on albumin-coated surfaces, wherein the cells don't bind very tightly to the surface, is the role of calcium transients negligible. If you allow them to move on fibronectin or vitronectin, where the binding is tight, then the calcium transients do play a role. And so, what they also found is that if you abolish the calcium transients, the cells are able to extend protrusions, they are simply unable to retract them. In other words, you have no impact on the ability of the cell to do the directional sensing and all that, but their subsequent ability to retract the pseudopod is seriously hindered. So when I looked at the model that I was developing, and you can see that in the model what is happening is that after the development of the polarization, you do have an increase in the level of IP3 inside the model. And IP3 we know to be necessary for the calcium-induced calcium release. To me, it seemed like a continuous train of events that was sort of able to sort of also yield the calcium transients that have been subsequently observed. Okay, and it's just a model, so you know, it was done some time ago, but I've never seen anybody even bring it up or even discuss it. It's just dismissed as not even relevant, so I don't know what the issue is. Calcium transients, I know that they're not it's not the case in dictyostelium, but in neutrophils, at least, you know, from a modeling standpoint, the way we look at it is, at least if there's some issue out there, at least there must be some explanation. Either the experiments are bad, or I don't know what it is. But anyway, I just thought I'd bring it to your attention.
I think one argument is physiologic. That's bullshit. That is, cells don't crawl on these things. Cells don't crawl on glass with anything. Mm-hmm. Well, they have zillions of things that they're attaching to at any given moment. What you've got yet is a cell moves very nicely, polarizes, shows directionality and so on albumin without any calcium transient.
Mm-hmm.
That means the whole thing can work without the calcium. The calcium, the idea is it's there just to trigger processes that allow deadherence.
Yes.
Allow
yes.
And that's
yes.
all it's necessary for.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be in anybody's model of anything.
Yes.
For the things you're talking about.
Yeah, but as I understood it from the talks today, abolishing calcium transients in many cases had no impact on the motility whatsoever.
Well, I think a lot of people think about that.
So my question is that one guy is saying that they can't move.
For the motility itself, it depends on if you really on a very adhesive surface, maybe calcium has some role, but it's not really part of the machinery.
But in vivo, there is fibronectin and vitronectin, right? Albumin is physiological?
Yep. You're full of albumin. So it's all of us.
Oh, you are just albumin.
No, all of us are full of albumin.
But in the body, is
yes,
it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So.
Everything coated with albumin.
Yeah. So both explanations are perfectly legitimate then? I mean, okay. All right. Okay.
It's
so.
Almost always in biology, it's both and.
Yes.
Okay.
And either or is albumin.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So now let me come to the mathematical model. And this is going to be pretty brief because I think you're all familiar with the Gitter-Meinhardt model. I will just present it pretty quickly. So we have three variables. There is an activator that lives in, so the cell, we view the cell as a 2D disk of radius r. The activator lives in the membrane, which is this circle over here. The inhibitor lives in the cytosol, and the stored phosphoinositides live in the endoplasmic reticulum, or actually the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, which is shown as this line over here. And as I pointed out earlier, we assume that this P and this P sub S cannot diffuse very far because they live in membranes. There are phospholipids living in the membranes, and that the inhibitor, which lives in the cytosol, can diffuse much faster than these things that live in the membrane. Okay, so once again, we're going to lump it up into three different compartments. This is the membrane phosphoinositides. This is one compartment. This is the cytosolic inhibitors that live in the cytosol, and this is the stored phosphoinositides that live in the endoplasmic reticulum. And this is showing once again that the membrane phosphoinositides have this autocatalytic feedback, and this arrow over here is showing that the receptors can provide some sort of an impetus to triggering off the autocatalytic process. Okay, so the model equations, essentially, we had, as I pointed out initially, some representation of adaptation of the receptors, which we have done away with now because the model that we had was not consistent. You know, we had dephosphorylation of receptors, which we subsequently realized was not the case, at least in the systems that have been studied. The rate of formation of the membrane phosphoinositides is simply some rate constant multiplied by the concentration of the active receptors, multiplied by the concentration of the stored phosphoinositides that are being brought here, and also this P squared dependence denotes the autocatalytic and the cooperative dependence upon P. Then we also have two terms that account for the fact that this stuff can also go back, you know, so this is a cycle, it's the rate of formation and the cycle taking the stuff back, and that is dependent upon both P and I. Okay. And you will notice this small term S multiplying this entire term here. That small term S comes about because the kinetics for P are defined on the membrane, whereas I lives inside the cytosol. So S is really the area per unit length, if you will. That simply accounts for the fact that concentrations have to be scaled accordingly. Then there are a couple of extra terms here that basically define the basal level that things operate, even if there is no receptor-mediated stuff going on. So there is a constant level here, basal level, constant level at which stuff is coming in, and some first-order rate at which it might decay, and likewise over here. And now I also bring in the diffusive terms, which account for the fact that actually P and P sub S diffuse, and I also diffuse. So finally, the third assumption we make is that the total amount of this and this is constant, okay, because it's just a transfer process. Stuff is being brought in and taken away, so the total amount is constant. Okay. The boundary conditions are essentially just periodic boundary conditions. So theta equal to 0 and 2 pi, everything must be the same. The concentrations at this end must be the same as the concentrations at this end, and likewise for the fluxes. And initial conditions, we assume the picture we have is that the cell is some sort of a homogeneous steady state, and at time t equal to 0, we will perturb the cell with various kinds of perturbations. Okay, so now...
Can you go back?
Sure.
This is only on the circumference?
Which one?
Well, I don't... I mean, this is a one-dimensional.
Yes.
Theta is the angle.
Theta is the angle.
So you're just doing this around the circumference somehow.
Assuming I doesn't depend on the radius.
I doesn't depend on the radius. Yes, it's
so it lives inside the ball.
Yeah.
So that's kind of simplification.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Okay.
And PR, PS is. I don't understand.
There should be, so if everything had to be okay, you would write a similar differential equation for P sub S.
Yes.
But what we assumed is that the diffusion coefficients for P and P sub S were the same. So then you can combine the two and get a result that says that they're basically conserved. The total amount is the same. So what this equation is saying is that the total amount P plus P sub S integrated over the entire length of the length of the two-dimensional cell is some constant. Yes.
And that you basically assume that there is one-to-one point-to-point correspondence of the inner membrane and the outer membrane, so you basically like, just really
It's
can just draw little two circles and
so that's
it's a simplification. You have seen the data and you know that you can make the models as fancy as you want, but we're arguing about pretty basic things here. Okay, so the first question here is the response to, so let me recall the data once again. The first thing was the response to the chemoattractant gradient. So what we did is basically, just to go back real quick, so what we're really doing here is essentially we provide different kinds of functions to the receptors and then watch what kind of a steady state the system goes to. And what we're showing over here is that essentially when you apply this kind of a gradient, and you can see that the receptor, the dimensionless receptor concentration, which is scaled, goes from about 1 to 1.2, so this is about a 20% gradient on the average across the length of the cell. What you find is that basically, this is its evolution in time. You can see that at time t equal to 0, it is flat, and then slowly it builds up in a manner characteristic of the Geher-Meinhardt model, goes up and develops into a steep profile. What you can also see is that this is actually lower than its pre-existing level earlier on, which is consistent with the intuitive explanation I gave to you earlier on, that at the back end of the cell, this stuff is being depleted away and being moved into the other organelle. You can also see here that the concentration profile of the inhibitor is flat, which is consistent with the fact that it can diffuse very fast, so it has a relatively flat profile, but that its value at the end, so this is where it was initially, ultimately, after 120 seconds, it acquires this profile, so it is at a higher level than it was to begin with. Okay? So this is consistent with the intuitive explanation that I gave at the beginning. Okay. Next, let me deal with the response to a uniform chemoattractant stimulus. And basically, the point I want to make here is that the chemoattractant concentration may be macroscopically uniform. no question about it, because you put a uniform concentration on top of the cell. But there might be significant fluctuations. In fact, there must be significant fluctuations. Now, what we have done is we have appealed, actually gone back to some work that was done by Tranquillo and Laufenberger in I think the mid-80s. And what they showed is that the fluctuations cannot be very significant at the level of the ligand concentration, but that the fluctuations are much more likely to be significant at the level of receptor ligand binding. Okay, so we have assumed a model, a stochastic model of receptor ligand binding, and so all the noise that is coming in the system is coming from the noise in the receptor ligand binding. So the simulations kind of look something like this. So at time t equal to zero, we add a bunch of chemoattractant to the cell, and this noise is then the noise, the receptor activation is a little noisy because of the receptor ligand binding. And what we're showing over here is the fact that with this little amount of noise, the system just takes off, and ultimately at some random location it develops into a peak. And just real quick, I mean, just if you recall, I just want to show you but yeah, that's a
not very local.
Yeah, but yeah, you can. So I can tell you. Yeah, these are modeling issues. You can change it.
That's probably.
Okay. I will tell you why. So what I am getting over here is I think what Kerner and Osipov, and since you're in the physics community, I can just in the theory of auto solitons, this is what he calls the broad soliton. If I had, and the reason why I'm getting a broad soliton is because I have this constraint P plus P sub S is equal to a constant. If I do not have that constraint, if the only constraint on the growth of the peak, if there is no constraint on the growth of the peak imposed by this mass balance, then it will continue to grow until diffusion makes it achieve a sort of a steady state, in which case you get what he calls sharp soliton, which is like a very, very sharply developed peak going up very high.
System,
yes.
As opposed to those little pictures, which really seem like they're spiking very, very locally, and it can be driven by a very different mechanism.
So what you're saying is there is no need for a global inhibitor in order to get this mechanism?
If I understood correctly, previous thoughts, surely there seems to be positive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but the amplification mechanism even here is local. It is the inhibition mechanism that is global.
It's local. This is not on the order.
Okay, so I showed you the response stimulus, and now I want to show you the next experiment, which was what happens when you switch the gradient. If you switch the gradient, as I showed you earlier on, this is, this was the experiment where if you switch the gradient, and the new gradient that you impose is shallow, then the pulse seems to move like a traveling wave from its original location to the new location. And that is the same experiment that we have simulated here, which is essentially showing to you that if this is the original profile to begin with that we imposed to get the original polarity, and then when we reverse the polarity, and then when we reverse the polarity, which is over here like this, if we impose a new gradient, you can see that it moves as a traveling wave from the original location to the new location. Okay? But if I do the same simulation by, instead of imposing a relatively mild gradient, I impose a steep gradient, which, as you recall, I meant a gradient which has no influence at the back of the cell. So in other words, this is my original gradient to make the peak develop. My new gradient is coming down so sharply that it is not even being felt over here at this point. You can see that basically the existing peak sort of comes down and a new peak develops at the other end. So it's as if one just dies and the other one develops, okay, which is sort of also consistent with the picture that was shown originally. Okay, so my next transparency is about two. So what I want to point out here is again another property of the Gearhart-Meinhardt model, and this is also something that can easily be checked experimentally. And that is the fact that, you know, somebody pointed out yesterday what would happen if you had two pipettes, you know, sort of pointing towards the cell. And the conclusion was that both the locations at which you point the pipette sort of light up with the GFP. This model actually predicts that even though you have two to begin with, ultimately only one will survive, one of them will go away. So what is being shown over here is essentially, if you have two unequal chemoattractant sources, and they are unequal by the slightest amount, very, very slightly, you can see that basically, initially, both of them start to develop, but ultimately only one of them grows, and the other one simply dies and comes back to the basal level. Okay, so I don't know what the experiments show, but I would imagine and hope that if I have a cell that is exposed to two different points, then it would seem that it will ultimately go in only one direction. It is unlikely to move in both at the same time. Yes? Yes, and I'll show you that next. Yeah, yeah. Beg your pardon? No, not really. I mean, it's not as much as you think, because actually you can prove that in the Gearhart-Meinhardt model, that if the ratio of the diffusion coefficients is very, very large, only a unique peak can be stable. All sorts of steady states can exist. You can get steady states with multiple peaks, but only the one with a single peak is stable. Yes, yeah, I agree with you. So if the spatial range is so large that the inhibitor's influence is not felt, then of course you can have it. So that is why I said that if the ratio between the two diffusion coefficients is sufficiently large, in other words, the inhibitor diffuses so fast that it occupies the entire area of the cell, then you cannot have more than one peak. Okay? And even that, okay, and I'll show you. I mean, I agree with you. Only if the two peaks are nearly identical. And I'm showing that to you in the next simulation. This is, they differ by less than 2%. Only in that case do you develop two simultaneous peaks. Okay, anything more than a 3 to 4% difference, which is unlikely to be realized in practice, gives you a unique peak. Okay. Finally, we also did some studies to investigate what might happen if you change the parameters of the model. In other words, roughly speaking, the idea here was to see if you change the rate constants for the activator or you change the rate constants for the inhibitor, what might this do to the geometry of the peak that you have formed? And roughly speaking, and consistent with intuition, what we find is that if you make the rate at which the phosphoinositides are formed faster, the peaks become broader. If you make the rates at which the inhibitors are formed faster, then the peaks become thinner. Okay? Okay, so actually I have one more, but I think I'm running a little bit over time, so I'll just basically conclude. Yeah, go ahead.
So what happens if you just remove the
gradient? If you see adaptation? No, we don't, because as I mentioned to you at the beginning, we have removed the adaptation. The equation that represented adaptation was at the level of receptors, and we were told that adaptation does not take place at the level of receptors, so we don't have any adaptation. If we had a reasonable model for adaptation, if we understood better, it could always be incorporated, and in that case you would see a diminishing trend. Okay, but that's why I can't get the stuff that I showed you at the... Beg your pardon? A mechanism for adaptation. I mean, I to the best of my knowledge, nothing is known about what causes adaptation. I mean, it was believed for some time that it was at the level of receptor, that the receptors got phosphorylated, but that is now no longer believed to be true. And I believe Chris published a paper, I think 2 years ago, in which they showed definitively that it is not at the level of the receptors. Okay. So anyway, to just summarize the conclusions once again, we set up basically a Gearhart-Meinhardt type of model, and we showed that the PIs can localize in response to both uniform and non-uniform gradients, and that in the uniform gradients it localizes if there is some level of noise at the level of receptor ligand binding. We also showed that their movement in response to changes in the gradient that you apply after they have polarized can be different depending upon the nature of the gradient that you apply. That the geometry of the peak changes, you know, depending upon whether you turn on or turn off the reactions that are involved in activating or inhibiting the reaction. And finally, at least according to the model, in all but the most difficult situations, which are unlikely to be realized in practice, you will get a unique peak. You may start off by developing two at the same time, or three, or even four. But left to itself for a certain period of time, there can be only one point at which the polarity develops. Unless you change the parameter values in such a way that multiple peaks can be entertained. Okay, but for the most part, you will get a single peak. Okay, so that's pretty much what I have to say. Yeah.